Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and today we're taking a look to begin the show at the Wisconsin State Historical Markers Program. And great to have Fitzy Heimdall with us. Fitzy is the coordinator of the program, and he oversees more than 600 historical markers. And that's a number that grows every year. It's a unique program, and it encourages and guides Wisconsin citizens and groups to establish historical markers in their communities. And we'll talk in detail about this program. And it's kind of a bottom-up approach, which I really like a lot. And I hope you'll join the conversation as we talk with Fitzy. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Do you have a favorite historical marker? Or maybe you're thinking there should be one in your community and have some questions about it. I hope you'll join in. Again, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Fitzy, thank you so much for joining in today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, good morning, Larry. It's a pleasure to be on the program.
Well, the Wisconsin State Historical Markers are, I guess, recognizable throughout the state as they're permanent plaques with a state seal, and they stand along roadsides and in town squares. Maybe just talk about the purpose of those markers.
Yeah, absolutely. So Wisconsin's historical markers are an excellent educational tool informing people about significant aspects of our state's past. These permanent outdoor markers are located often near or at the place where something significant occurred. They're located in almost all of Wisconsin's 72 counties. I say almost all, as I hope we might have some listeners in Florence County, as that's the only county that currently doesn't have an official state historical marker. As we begin our conversation, I'll note that I'll be primarily discussing our state's official markers program. There are many different types of markers and markers programs, everything from city markers to county historical society markers to more regional markers or even other agencies that produce their own markers. But we are talking primarily about the Wisconsin official state historical markers, the brown background with cream lettering on them.
They're really, really cool. One of my favorites, or maybe the certainly the one that I've stopped the most at, is the John Muir View marker, which is near Poinette. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I stopped there is because you've got a great view. I mean, you have John Muir's view right there, and it's kind of a breathtaking view, especially at different times of the season. I always try and make a point to stop at different points in the season. But let's go to the history of this thing. How did this get started? It was back in the 50s, wasn't it?
It was. It was So the markers in general, historic markers, date back. The oldest state marker program is Virginia, which is dating back to 1927. Wisconsin's program started back in 1943 when then-Governor Walter Goodland appointed people to be the first historical marker committee. And the reason behind this, or the goal, was to create a system that would unite the histories of our communities through a standard and uniform design. Prior to that, folks were putting up markers, but there was nothing uniform about it. There was no centralized system to review them. And that's where the state really was interested in developing more of a formalized process.
Yeah.
So in 1950, the committee was formed, and in 1953, an official law was passed to establish the markers program.
That's pretty cool, and as it's a bottom up kind of organization. Explain that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, any organization, individual, entity is encouraged to submit a nomination for an official Wisconsin State Historical Marker. As long as it meets the defined criteria, which are, you know, events that have made a significant contribution to our history, individuals who are no longer living, art or architecture, prehistory or archaeology, ethnic groups, eras that represent significant aspects of our physical or natural history, as well as legends and lore. And they are encouraged to apply through the Wisconsin Historical Society. We serve as, you know, basically an administrative review process. And so folks will be doing the research. They will conduct the writing of the text, securing permission primarily to place the marker in a prominent location. As you mentioned, a lot of them are located along our wayside rest pull-offs. So making sure that they're visible and accessible for the general public is important. But what we do from the Historical Society is we review it. We make sure all of the marker application is complete. We fact check it. And then we work with the local applicant as well, you know, to offer suggestions on their text. We have a marker review committee comprised of various staff members. And really, we want to help our local applicants get to the final product of having their state historical marker dedicated and having a uniform style of writing and language.
Yeah, makes sense. Kevin emailed a little contrary view of this. He says the markers are often not supported by the state, but rather private organizations that have an agenda. And so Kevin says they never stop to look at those markers. Now, sounds to me like their markers are supported by the state, but go ahead and react to Kevin's comment.
Sure. And so he raises up an interesting point where, as being driven primarily at the local level, it is the local applicant's responsibility to fund the marker themselves. We work with our local applicants both to make sure that the marker nomination meets the criteria. We also work with our local partners or applicants to work on the text. And so when both sides reach an agreement on the proposed text, that's when the Wisconsin Historical Society places the order on behalf of the marker applicants. You know, we look at making sure that the text is factually accurate. We look to make sure that the marker text is, you know, certainly doesn't have any bias as well, and accurately portrays the history that's being told. And oftentimes what we do is we work with our local applicants to, you know, to explain how the particular topic rises to regional, state, or even national significance, as that's a big point of what the Historical Marker Program tells.
So the first one, what did the first one commemorate?
The first marker was dedicated back in 1951, and it was dedicated to the Peshtigo Fire. It's marked in the cemetery where many victims lost their lives, and actually one of the deadliest fires in our nation's history. Since its first marker in 1951, we have now almost 620 official state historical markers all across the state.
Yeah, I looked at the map, and it looks like I missed the fact that there isn't one in Florence County, but it looked like it pretty much wherever you are in the state, you're going to be able to find one. And that map gives the information on how to find those is in there as well.
Correct. And we make sure to update that map, and there's also a PDF list, and those are updated very frequently when new markers are dedicated. On average, that's anywhere from between 8 to, I'd say, 20 new markers are installed on a given year.
So that's pretty good. How many are in the pipeline right now?
There's actually quite a few. I would say we've about doubled our applications and the nominations we've received. We've received some additional funding, which I'd be happy to talk about as well. But I would say we've got about 20 marker nominations in the pipeline in various stages of review and approval.
So as long as you mentioned funding, let's talk about funding, because the a lot of it comes from the local area, if I'm not mistaken.
That's true, and that is something that we've recognized as a potential barrier. Being primarily driven at a local level and having the funding come from the local level, you know, these markers can cost anywhere from a few hundred dollars all the way upwards to almost $8,000. And so depending on the size of the marker and the amount of character counts that the markers have, you know, that's a determining factor on who gets to have a marker in the first place. You know, it takes a lot of work and effort to not only raise the funds to erect a historical marker, but to do the research and the writing as well, and to secure the necessary permissions for that marker.
And they have
take anywhere from up to a year.
Up to a year. And they have a definite look and a definite style that is pretty much for every one of those markers, correct?
That's correct. And that is certainly a purposeful decision to have that uniform, you know, the brown and cream marker with the badger emblem at the very top. That's what distinguishes our official state historic marker from others.
And the funding, you mentioned there was some additional funding coming through?
That's correct. We've been fortunate enough to work with the William J. Pomeroy Foundation, a national organization based out of New York that has a real interest in funding historical markers. One of the gaps that we found through an intensive survey of all of our existing markers was, you know, what were the stories that were being told? What were the stories that weren't being told? And how were the stories being told in the first place? You know, who was the one who was writing the text, or who was the one who was telling the stories, and from whose perspective? And as part of that study, we found that there is a large underrepresentation in African American stories being told, women's history being told, no markers being told of recent immigrant history, Latinx, Hmong, refugees. There were previously no LGBTQ plus markers. Fortunately, because of this funding, those have changed, and we've been fortunate enough to be able to provide some support to organizations to fund and write those types of markers as well. And so I think we're seeing some positive change in having more of a full representation in the stories and the histories that are being told through the markers program.
Yeah. Fitzy Heimdall, our guest today, he is the Wisconsin State Historical Markers Program Coordinator, works out of the Wisconsin Historical Society. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in, or maybe you've got something to share regarding a specific one of the markers that you that exist perhaps in your area, or maybe you have a question about one that you'd like to have. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk about the Upper Mississippi River with Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazines. That's at 12 o'clock today. Right now, though, we're taking a look at the Wisconsin State Historical Markers Program with our guest, Fitzy Heimdall, who is coordinator of the program at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Questions or comments, or maybe an experience with one of those markers, I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address is talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We'd certainly love to hear from you as we move along throughout the program. So grant money is $75,000. Did you say that was in grant money to diversify the stories?
That's correct. Yep. And our goal is to provide the funds for up to 25 new state historical markers to better reflect the rich and diverse history of our state.
That's pretty cool. I know this year some of the grant money is being spent putting up 9 new historical markers in Milwaukee that highlights the city's place in the civil rights movement.
Yeah, absolutely. It's as many folks may know that throughout the 60s, Milwaukee was the site of a massive influential civil rights movement that combated racial discrimination and segregation in housing, employment, and education. Part of the broader national movement for civil rights. From August 1967 to March of 1968, the Youth Council and its protective unit, the Commandos, led 200 consecutive nights of protests for fair housing. As a result of that, in 1968, the U.S. government passed the National Fair Housing Act prohibiting discrimination based on race. On April 30th, the Milwaukee passed its own fair housing bill 6 years after Alderwoman Belle Phillips first introduced it to the council. And we're working with a group called March on Milwaukee, a grassroots organization of former NAACP Youth Council members and commandos, community organizers, historians, and more. And what's really unique is that the marchers themselves, you know, they have direct input in what's being said in the text. They're a central part in the development of the writing of the text based on their lived experiences.
And where will the, and obviously the markers are going to be placed around Milwaukee, but where specifically will some of them be placed?
Sure. So there are two of them currently. One of them is located outside North Division High School. They're marking the specific sites that were very significant during those 200 nights of protests. And so there's going to be one, for example, at the 16th Street Viaduct. There'll be one in a couple of Milwaukee's county parks dedicated to the Freedom Houses, where a lot of the organizing happened during those marches. We're hoping to dedicate one near the former Eagles Club, which was also a pivotal site during that era. So we're really looking to place them in close proximity to where the events occurred during that time.
Very cool. Ned in Florence, Wisconsin. Florence County? Ned?
This is Ned in Florence. I happen to be a member of the Florence County Historical Society.
All right. Well, we've learned earlier that Florence County doesn't have one of the Wisconsin Historical Society or Wisconsin State Historical Markers.
Yeah, I just learned that's one of the many things I've learned on your program, Larry.
Well, what do you think? Are there some possibilities?
Yeah, we do have a nice marker where the home where the Charles Woolsey grew up, who was a hero of World War One, led the Lost Battalion, which I guess was pretty famous back in that day. And we have plaques in some of the buildings, but I guess we don't have an official one.
Well, all right. Well, let's talk to Fitzy here for a minute. Fitzy, how does Ned and his Florence County Historical Society group go forward on this if they want to apply?
Yeah, that's a great question, I'm so glad to have you on the line. Well, the first step is to fill out a pre-application form on our main program website, which will be listed on the page here. Mm-hmm. But it's a simple pre-application form that basically determines the eligibility for the program. You know, the last thing we want to do is have folks go through the entire application process just to find out that perhaps their nomination doesn't quite meet the qualifications for the State Historical Markers Program. So that's the first step. And then once given the go-ahead to submit the final application and a $250 application fee, you will work with us directly on making sure that all the information is there. And you know, we're happy to help you throughout that entire process as well. That's what we're here for.
Yeah. So, Ned, if you type in Wisconsin State Historical Markers Program, it's going to pop up. And we'll have a link on our page today at the Larry Mueller, WPR.org/Larry. If you go to today's date, we'll have in the comments section, there'll be a link. But I think you could just type in Wisconsin Historical Society Markers Program, it'll pop up. Ned, does that help?
Yeah, I think it might get us started. We'll see what happens here. And thanks for your program.
All right, appreciate it very much. Well, maybe we can finally get Florence County to join the rest of our counties.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate it. Well, Greg in Minocqua. Oh, we lost Greg in Minocqua. The Marinette County Historical Marker is—he's happy and sad. I don't know what he means by that. How are the? It may have something to do with how the markers are kept up.
Mm-hmm. So that's another great question too. And one thing that's maybe a little unique about Wisconsin's State Historical Marker Program is that when a local applicant applies for a state historical marker, they technically become the owner of the state historical marker too. And, you know, while the markers are designed to last in perpetuity, some of those earlier markers, you know, from the 50s and 60s do start to show their wear over time. And, you know, we work with local applicants, if they're still around, or local communities to get the resources needed to have these markers refurbished. You know, refurbishment options are certainly there. Sometimes, you know, if a marker's old enough and some of these older markers have marker text that's problematic or perhaps is found to be factually inaccurate, we would then work with them to potentially create a new state historical marker as well.
So there's options and possibilities there for that. You can join in too. Maybe you have a comment about a historical marker in your area, or maybe just a question about the whole process. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. You mentioned revising. Have there been situations where you've done some revising?
You know, there are. Americans' understanding of the past regularly evolves, and so do historians' role to interpret that history. The problem, of course, with historical markers is that they don't change, and so sometimes we have text or interpretation that, by today's standards, would be considered inaccurate or even offensive. And the State Historical Society does have the regulatory authority to request a removal of a marker if so determined. And what we do is we would work with the original owner or applicant, if they're still around, as well as local community partners, and in particular, the groups that are directly impacted by the story being told. Close collaboration on whether there's interest in a new marker, as well as consultation and having that marker removed.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think there was one on a marker on Madeline Island that was replaced, if I'm not mistaken.
That's true. And that was done actually last fall in September of 2023. And that's one where the marker was actually owned by the Wisconsin Historical Society. And so we were able to replace that marker. It's retitled Munawanakaning, which is the Anishinaabe name for Madeline Island, meaning home of the yellow-breasted flickerbird. The original marker was erected in 1961, and that one inaccurately stated that the island was discovered by the French. The new marker was developed using input from the Bad River and Red Cliff Ojibwe communities, and today it recognizes the central role of Indigenous peoples in the island's history.
It makes makes a lot of sense to me. Someone else is wondering, how's the location of a historical marker determined?
That's a great question. And what we look for in terms of a location is, most commonly, its accessibility. Is the proposed location for a marker accessible to folks who would either be walking or, more commonly, driving? We have quite a following of our state historical markers, and we actually have a few folks who make it a goal of theirs to travel and visit every single marker that there is across the state. And so, you know, they need a place to park. They need a place where it's visible, visible at all times. So, you know, if it's located inside a building or a gated area that might be closed at certain times, we would encourage them to look for potentially a different location as well.
And the descriptions, talk about the descriptions that, I mean, somebody is looking to hit all 620 of them that currently exist. You need some good directions, and you provide that.
We do. We've got, you know, as I said before, there's that online interactive map. We also have a PDF list of all of our state historical markers, both of which are regularly updated. And there's instructions and directions on those on where they're located. There's another great website that's not affiliated with the Wisconsin Historical Society, but it's a group of volunteers who went out and created a website called the Historical Marker Database. That has information on, you know, pretty much any and all historical marker that there might be across the country. You know, whether it's a state marker, a local marker, they're pretty robust in having as many markers listed there as possible. And I think at the last count, there were about 180,000 markers across the country that were listed on that site. So it's truly remarkable how many markers there are in our landscape.
Oh, man. Let's talk about some. I'm surprised we're not getting more calls on this, because it surprises me that more people don't want to talk about their own marker. If you've got a marker that you want to promote, give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or maybe just send an email. You can email us to talk@wpr.org. There's a state historical marker commemorating the Green Bay Packers that went missing. Talk about that.
Yeah, so that's an interesting one, and that does occasionally happen. We sometimes do get reports of markers that go missing. You know, most often those reports come in from members of the public who, you know, they were trying to go see a marker and it wasn't at its listed location. And when I get those calls or emails, I need to do a little bit of investigative research and, you know, see who the applicant was, where the marker was located, and then from there try to determine what might have happened to the markers. A lot of times it might be related to construction projects. Marker might have been taken down and have plans to put back up when construction is finished. But this particular marker dedicated to the Green Bay Packers was one that was on our list for quite a few years, certainly before my time and before a couple of our other folks' time. And there was a recent article where, out of the blue, this marker, it showed up again. Apparently, it had been removed, and according to the individual, was found near a dumpster, and it eventually made its way all the way to Ohio.
A guy by the name of Weasel.
Yeah.
You found the marker damaged in a dumpster, And he said he was played in a band or something, I guess. And the band, they saw it, and then they went and played in their band, and then they came by again, and it was still in the dumpster. And so he said they had to get it out. He said it was heavy. It weighed like 300 pounds. Mm-hmm. But it was damaged, and they pulled it. He said, you know, I figured if it's in a dumpster, it must be okay for me to take. So
it's a wild story.
It's a wild story. So sometime after 2003, he took it home to Ohio, and there it sat. Now, I don't know. I don't think it's made its way back, has it?
Not to my knowledge. And, again, since the program is so locally driven, if there was the desire to have a new marker replaced, we'd certainly be happy to work with the Packers or the foundation to have that installed.
it was a great story. Weasel. Lynn in Spring Green, let's go to you now. Thanks for calling, Lynn. What's on your mind?
Good morning. This is lovely timing. And thanks for taking my call. I have kind of an old curiosity, but a recent, really, I'm actively curious about the old military road that, and there's apparently more than one, that ran through Wisconsin. And there are segments, I found a few segments in different places up by, was it by Three Rivers and outside Fond du Lac and in Fond du Lac and outside Madison and so on and so forth. And I've just started researching this, and I think I'm going to actually pursue looking at this more. When I went to look, oh gosh, a couple years ago, no, maybe last year, I did a writing road trip, and I did the back roads, and it was wonderful to run into some of the historical markers. For example, the one to Chief Waupaca, outside Waupaca, and I would run into them quite by accident, but taking the blue highways and the back roads, and this is the first I knew that there was a website. So I'm going to be looking for that. A real specific question, though, do you know if there is any kind of historical marking about the old military roads?
That's a great question, and there are. I can think of a few in particular. There's one in Iowa County that was erected back in 1961. With the title, The Old Military Road, the Fort Crawford to Prairie du Chien and Fort Howard road, the portage. There's actually one in Langlade County as well. I know there's one in Dane County, and we're actually working with an applicant to erect another one potentially in the Madison area, close to where the military road went as well. This one will have more of a focus on the Native American history of travel, but certainly those old roads, their history goes back thousands of years before that as well, following established trails.
Yeah. Lynn, sounds like you've got some opportunity there. Now, how would Lynn find those out? Would she just what would she do to find out where those are all located?
Yeah, so a great way to do it, again, looking at the map. But if you reach out to me directly, I can send you a Excel spreadsheet or send you the number of markers that there are specifically. Being over 600 and almost 20 markers, if there's a specific marker or a theme of markers that folks are interested in, I can certainly do some research and create an itinerary for them.
And how does Lynn find your email address?
Yeah, my email address is on the Wisconsin Historical Society webpage. That's the best way to reach me, via email or phone. But happy to assist folks in discovery of markers and through the application process of new markers as well.
And Lynn, it's Fitzy Heimdall who you're talking with here. And Fitzy is the program coordinator for the Historical Society. Does that all help?
That's absolutely wonderful. I literally just came back from Horicon and the Fond du Lac area, kind of working on this project yesterday. So this is great. And I will look you up. Do I say Fitzy? Is that right?
Yep, correct.
All right, I will find you. I appreciate this. This is a great program. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. You know, I looked up the origins of Fitzy, and it's an old German origin that means peaceful ruler. In old German. So you're kind of the peaceful ruler of this program. So that's pretty cool. Lynn, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Clayton in Roscoe, Illinois next. Hi, Clayton.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to state, growing up, those historical markers, they played a big role in our family life. I grew up in northeast Iowa, and we travel all across southern Wisconsin. There was the Battle of Bad Axe there by Prairie du Chien, and all the way across to Illinois, we'd stop during family vacations at almost everyone along the line, the Lead region, and a whole bunch of them. And they played a big role growing up in our lives, so I just wanted to state that.
Oh, Clayton, thanks a lot for calling. Do you get that kind of response, Fitzy?
I do. I often get folks who, you know, either their parents or now they are parents, and they'll go and stop at any and all historical markers that they find along their route. And, you know, it's a great way to learn about our local history. And even in my role, it's always fun to learn these stories and these histories that are important to our local communities. I certainly learn a lot, too, by what is submitted and nominated for state historical markers.
Yeah, absolutely. Renata in Lake Mills, we'll go to you. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm calling to say my favorite marker, which is the 45th parallel in Door County that sits between Jackson Port and Bailey's Harbor. And that's my favorite. But I do have a question for you about markers. Are there any markers that describe our state's rich history in the canning factory industry, having some of the largest ones in the world at some points in history, but also the migrant communities that worked at them? And I wondered if there's any recognition of that. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling, Renata.
Yeah, that is a great question. And, you know, I don't think there are specifically to that topic. There's many that are dedicated to, you know, Wisconsin's rich industrial and commercial history. But specific to canning and the folks that worked in that industry, I don't think that there are.
I was trying to think. I thought I saw one near Sun Prairie that had to do with peas, but that might have been just another marker, but not a Wisconsin Historical Society one.
Right. And that certainly could be the case.
All right. Well, that's something else for people to look at and think about in their particular areas, because if you've got some background, or at least know a little bit about the migrant history that for the area, or maybe the canning industry in that area. There's certainly canning as vegetables has been a really large part of our history. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. Larry Mueller here talking with Fitzy Heimdall, Wisconsin State Historical Markers Program Coordinator for the Wisconsin Historical Society for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Just a look ahead to tomorrow on the show. We talk with Craig Handel about helping groundskeeper George Toma write his biography. It's titled The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields. Then we talked to John Greenberg, president of the Milwaukee Admirals hockey team. That's tomorrow. Right now, we're taking a look at the Wisconsin State Historical Markers Program with the coordinator of it, Fitzy Heimdall. And Stephen Washburn has something for us. Let's go there. Steve, thank you for calling.
Good morning. And I want to say I appreciate the markers. My family and I always stop and look. But I do have the concern that especially some of the dated ones are coming from a white man's perspective. And just, for example, the guest just mentioned a marker about a battle. It was possibly closer to a massacre that took place in a battle, in some people's opinions. So I'm wondering what steps the guest takes to keep the markers current and culturally appropriate.
Good question, Steve. Thank you very much for calling.
Indeed, and that is certainly an accurate statement. You know, in particular, I'll say related to our Native American history. Here in Wisconsin, we have about 120 markers that mention Native American history or Indigenous history. But the problem we face with a lot of them is perhaps that history wasn't written by an Indigenous perspective or from tribal historians. And some of those older markers, as the listener mentioned, they reflect that style of writing, and they reflect who wrote the text. Those are some of the markers, our more recent markers, we've been able to work with our tribal historic preservation officers and our Native Nations to give them the resources to work with us and to have markers that are dedicated and centered on the Indigenous perspective and their cultures and stories. And so, you know, there's certainly a lot of them, and I'm hopeful in the direction that we're taking, though, to really give voices to those whose stories are being told through the Markers program.
Yeah, and as you mentioned earlier, there have been some changes made, and there's some money available for correcting or reworking many of those signs, and hopefully they can all be reflective of true history. Let's put it that way. Yeah. Steve, thank you very much. A good comment and question. Margaret in Mosinee, you've got a favorite marker.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call, Larry. My favorite marker is in a county park on Lake Dubé, and it's titled John Baptiste Dubé. And it gives some history on John Baptiste Dubé, and it mentions a Native American Indian chief, and he and Baptiste Dubé married the daughter of that Indian chief. And it said that this was a crossing point near here. I don't remember all the other details of that marker, but it's very, very interesting.
Fitzy, a comment?
Thank you for that. Yes, I mean, specifically to that marker, one of the key questions is whether it's an official state historical marker or another marker in general. I don't know that specific one off the top of my head. But, you know, your questions about favorite markers inspired me to pick two of them, and they're both food-related. One of them is a marker that's dedicated to Colby Cheese in Colby, Wisconsin, home of Colby Cheese. And the other is dedicated to the milkshake in Two Rivers, Wisconsin, the birthplace of the milkshake.
Oh, a couple of other ones. Margaret, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Donna in Eau Claire, we'll go to you.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if Francis Willard, who was involved with the prohibition of alcohol, and also suffragette, if there was a marker for her anywhere
in the
Janesville area.
In the Janesville area. And the name of the woman again?
Frances Willard, W-I-L-L-A-R-D.
Okay, Frances Willard. Well, I tell you what, Fitzy's looking it up right now to see if we have a marker.
Unfortunately, there's not, but there probably should be. And that is also one of the, one of the underrepresented histories that we find in the markers program is, unfortunately, there's very few women that these markers are dedicated to. And, you know, we certainly would love to see that change.
So, Donna, I know you formerly lived in Janesville, but if you've got some friends there, you might send them a note to listen to this show or to take a look at the State Historical Markers Program. It's on the Wisconsin Historical Society website, I believe. And they may want to put in a proposal for it. So if you've got some contacts there, or I guess you could probably do it yourself, but it'd probably better if to have the local folks leading that. Thank you. Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Your turn. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I just wanted to inquire. I grew up in Crestwood on the west side of Madison. The formal name is the Wisconsin Cooperative Housing Association, and it was spearheaded by John Bordner, who was he was very prominent in land planning around the country. It is a co-op, and each lot, what happened was a group of people got together, they bought a farm, they divided it into cul-de-sacs. So every street in the community is a cul-de-sac, and each lot is relatively small in order to keep the price
down.
Affordable at that time, which was like the mid to late 30s. And each lot is adjacent to a park area, which is shared space for everybody to enjoy. And there are, I don't remember how many acres, but there's quite a few acres of shared space in the community.
Hmm.
And it each lot carries one, has one share in the co-op attached to it. So when you buy, they're all built up now. So when you buy your house, you acquire a share in the co-op, and there's an annual meeting and.
Yeah.
Community parties and gatherings, and it's a really a very special community.
Fitzy?
Yeah, that's, you know, I don't see any state historical marker dedicated to that particular community, but I certainly think it would qualify for the markers program. Many times we see nominations for historical markers that are dedicated to the overall history of a community. And so certainly that is a possible topic and a eligible nominee.
And I'm thinking back to my days of taking a class in cooperatives here at the UW, and the cooperative movement got started here in Wisconsin and then spread nationally, but it started here in our state. And here we are out of time. Fitzy, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, and I invite anybody to take a look at that program, State Historical Markers Program, and maybe you've got something that you want to have included. Worth a try. Fitzy, thanks again. Oh, and there is a Francis Willard marker in River Forest, Illinois. So there's one in River Forest, Illinois. Fitzy Heimdall is the Wisconsin State Historical Markers Program Coordinator. Great to have him with us. Of course, he works out of the Wisconsin Historical Society. Coming up, a look at Big River Magazine and Life Along the Mississippi. I'm Larry Mealer. time to take a look at life along the Mississippi River with our guest, Reggie McLeod, editor of and publisher of Big River Magazine. The November-December issue was recently mailed to subscribers. I got mine in the mail. And as usual, the magazine includes many fascinating articles about all kinds of things, wildlife conservation, economic struggles of river communities. Maybe you have a connection to the Mississippi River. Maybe you live in the Driftless area, or maybe you just visit. How do you describe your quality of life in this beautiful region? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Reggie McLeod, thanks for joining us again. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, I always have a good time, yeah. Good afternoon, I should say. I'm used to saying good morning when I've been on this show.
That's right. Usually you're the first on. Well, today you're the second, and it's great to have you here. And the November-December issue, hot off the presses, and maybe just remind our listeners what the magazine is all about.
Well, since 1992, we've been covering the Mississippi River from the Twin Cities to the Quad Cities, which includes the entire Wisconsin west coast on the river, and the Driftless area too, the tributaries and so on.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure for me, and there are so many stories in every issue. It's a pleasure to read. A couple of articles in the new issue note that 2024 was the 100th anniversary of the Upper Mississippi River Wildlife and Fish Refuge. Can you talk about the importance of the refuge? Extremely important.
Well, a lot of the river, if you were to travel down the river, you'd see levees on both sides, and you wouldn't really see the towns in a lot of places and houses and so on. And when the refuge was established 100 years ago, it was basically done to prevent building levee districts all along the stretch. And it goes from Rock Island, Illinois, up to Lake Pepin. So it's 261 miles of the river that was protected from that kind of development. So we have the backwaters and probably thousands of islands and back channels and marshes and all of that that wouldn't be there if they hadn't established the refuge. And it was largely the work of one man, which kind of makes it interesting. He used to take the summers on the river and fish every day and so on, and he realized there was a big plan afoot to build levee districts, especially from around Prairie du Chien north up to Lake Pepin. And he started a campaign and started the Isaac Walton League, and it's interesting, women had just gotten the right to vote, and he got some of the major national women's groups behind him, and he got the whole thing done in about a year, which
is amazing.
Which is the most amazing thing of all. Things like that don't happen that quickly now, and they probably didn't back then either. It was quite an accomplishment. So yeah, that's what we're celebrating this year.
Yeah, his name is Will Dilg. Interesting lad. D-I-L-G, interesting last name. You know, in September, we broadcast this show from La Crosse, and we talked then to the refuge manager, Sabrina Chandler. And she had some things to tell you about how the birthday of the refuge was celebrated.
Yeah. She, we worked with a bunch of groups in that whole stretch of the river and with various districts of the refuge. And there were all different sorts of celebrations. There were river cleanups and conferences and just sometimes just parties. But we brought a lot of attention on the river. You know, it's, I've said quite a few times this year that it's something that's so big that the people who live around here don't see it. And it's kind of, we just kind of take it for granted, but you can go out there on an island and pitch a tent and stay there for a couple weeks, and you don't have to register with anybody or pay for doing that. I mean, it's this beautiful, huge public space that people enjoy in so many different ways. At this time of year, a lot of people are duck hunting and driving along the river and looking at the leaves. And, it's an amazing resource, and it's a wonderful place to live, too.
I want to go back to Will Dilg for a minute, because you reviewed a new documentary film titled A Visit from Will Dilg. How can people see that film?
Well, it's a little tricky now. I think Stephen Markin, who has been working as a river laureate on the big tour boats, and he grew up on the Mississippi River in Onalaska, just upstream of La Crosse, and both his parents were involved in the river a lot. And he really dug in when this whole celebration started, and he started doing a show as kind of a Will Dilg impersonator. You know how we've all seen Hal Holbrook and some of the people who do Mark Twain like that. So he did that with Will Dilg in order to tell the whole story of Dilg's relationship with the river, as well as how the refuge was established. And he's also a trained opera singer too. So, he spends a lot of time on the river. He has a houseboat that I think he lived on that most of this last summer. But he was doing performances at a lot of these events, and he's added video to them. They were kind of a hybrid performance of video and live action. And then he used that material to develop a really, really great 50-minute film about Will Dilg. And it's beautiful. He's a very talented photographer, too. We've had quite a few covers of the magazine that were photographs that he took of the river. So he brought all those skills together and made a very informative, really interesting movie. But right now it's for sale at his performances, and I think he's working on making it available for wider distribution, so you can buy a copy.
Very, very cool. Mm-hmm. You mentioned ducks, or you mentioned duck hunters, and you had an article about the duck population drop among especially the female mallards. The populations have fallen in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and talk about why that's the case.
Well, I don't know that they're absolutely sure why, but they suspect that part of it is the drought, and a lot of ducks breed in the pothole region, which is in western Iowa and Minnesota and eastern South Dakota. And because of the drought this year, some of those potholes where they nested were drying up. And because the females tend to spend, more time on the nest, they were more vulnerable to predators like coyotes, which are also in this issue.
Yes.
Coyotes and other predators. So that's kind of what they're speculating. It's, duck populations fluctuate a lot anyway, and part of that is they're also vulnerable during migration, and that's one of the great things about the refuge is it's the major bird migration corridor, right through the middle of the country. But if you just screw up one part of that migration route, it has a big impact on those migrating birds, and sometimes I think that affects the duck population as well. But in this case, it looks like it's a combination of the drought and maybe some other things.
Yeah. Reggie McLeod, our guest, of editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Questions for him? I hope you'll join in, or comments about the area. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I see there were some expansion plans for a large dairy operation in Pierce County, Wisconsin. It's causing some controversy. Some local residents say the farm intends to spread manure on fields without permission from the landowners. How could talk about that for a bit?
Well, that's always been a big problem with factory farms, is disposing of the manure. And some of these factory farms generate as much waste like that as a small to medium-sized city. I mean, they're large operations, and typically the way that they deal with it is they spread it on cropland as fertilizer. And those new factory farms are pretty contentious a lot of times now when they have a plan to open one. And the DNR and local officials want to know that they have sufficient land to spread the manure so it won't just pile up next to a stream and then there's a storm, it ends up in the stream in the Mississippi River. And they're discovering now that a lot of plans include a certain amount of cropland to spread the manure on, but when they look at the details of these plans, sometimes the land that they say they're going to spread the manure on, they don't have a contract for that land. They haven't really worked it out. So in this case, they found that was true of the folks that were trying to get the permit. They really hadn't arranged to find enough land to spread that safely. And then safely is kind of contested because a lot of times that just washes off into the water, and a lot of times it's not really used as fertilizer because they put nitrogen on the land before they do that. So there's way more, nitrates on the land than the crops really need. And when that happens, it ends up in the groundwater and surface water and causes problems.
JP in Bluff Siding, Wisconsin. JP, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, guys. What an honor to talk to you both today. Greatly appreciate your time.
You bet. What's on your mind?
Reading the magazine, I'm not a published writer, but I am considered a mud duck over here just by Fountain City. And I noticed in the magazine that we could possibly mail in articles to you guys to possibly be in the Big River magazine. So I'm just curious today on what you guys actually look for material-wise, whether it be like historical fiction or a story, or what do you guys kind of look for to putting good content together in the magazine? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah, good question. The magazine covers a lot of different topics.
Yeah.
But what I usually ask people who are interested in writing is, A, are they familiar with the magazine? Do they know what sorts of things we write about and kind of our perspective on those? And then also I ask them for a writing sample of something they've done that they're particularly proud of. It doesn't even have to be about the river. I just want to kind of see how they write when they have a passion about a subject. So that's usually how we start off. We get a lot of memoir, and we don't use a lot. So, and we generally don't use poetry. So, and we try to take a journalistic slant on most of the content, too. So that's kind of a quick summary of what we look for.
Yeah, there you go, JP. Thank you so much for calling. Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Just a reminder, if you miss part of our show or you want to hear it again, or maybe you want to hear it for the first time as somebody told you about it, you can always go to our archives. Just go to WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of our broadcasts, and you can search by topic or date, and they go back years. I've been around a long time, and there are a lot of old shows on there. So feel free to avail yourself. Today we visit with Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. We're talking about issues along the Mississippi River and news about the river. Join in if you have a question or comment or maybe an experience to share. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Reggie had a piece on some wetlands that are being protected, about 200 acres of wetlands, I think, along in Grant County, along the Wisconsin River.
Yeah, over by Woodman, which is upstream of Prairie du Chien a few miles. And that's a really interesting stretch. Well, the whole Wisconsin River is an interesting stretch, but along there, that's kind of right across from the confluence where the Kickapoo flows into the Wisconsin River, and there's a lot of nice wetlands in there and islands and so on, the lower Wisconsin Riverway is just a big stretch of the Wisconsin that's mostly public land, and this just adds to it. It keeps growing, and the Kickapoo River Reserve, I think it's called, or the Kickapoo mm-hmm. Reserve. That keeps growing too. So some of these confluences are being protected more and more too. So it just expands on that. It's really a great place to canoe, and it's pretty quiet, and there's not a lot of people living in Woodman, and it's 1,400 acres of wildlife habitat. That's a big deal.
Yeah, it is indeed. Conrad in Delavan has a question. Conrad, what's on your mind?
Hi. Regarding spreading the manure on the fields, is there proposed legislation going forward to make these big dairy farms use like biodigesters or create biomass fuel? Because there are technologies out there. I'm sure they don't want to spend the money to actually have the manure broken down and basically composted, so it's not such a problem with the groundwater and the soil and nature. So right now they're getting a free hand by being able to spread this manure at very little cost. I'll take my answer offline.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. There was an interesting case. I don't know if it made it to the Supreme Court, but in Colorado, people were going to claim that some of this activity was actually solid waste disposal rather than agriculture. Agriculture is protected, but they were arguing that if the soil already had sufficient nutrients in it, that it was actually solid waste disposal. That case got shot down, so that didn't happen. The biogas is really interesting, and I think it's a good idea, and I think it is more trouble for people, and they tried to site one outside of Winona. I think they might still be trying to do that, and the people who live near it were concerned about the odor and the truck traffic and that kind of thing. But it is a source of energy, and it produces methane, which is what natural gas is, basically methane, that you can burn, and you could generate electricity with it, or, you know, use it as you would natural gas.
Yeah.
And then the residue that's left over is more efficient to spread and incorporate into the soil than just fresh manure would be, too. So it has a lot of benefits, but like so many things, it gets complicated when you get into the implementation.
Yeah. I think there is one a farm that's doing that near Watertown, Wisconsin, and they're generating electricity, I think, enough for 100 homes or something like that, a large number of homes. So there, it can be done. There's no doubt about that. It can be done.
It seems more productive than just, you know, when you spread fresh manure, it evaporates, and that releases a lot of greenhouse gases, too, when it breaks down in the air like that, too. So it's not a great way of dealing with it, especially a lot of it.
You know, you had a nice story that I kind of liked, and it's got some good and some bad in it in some ways. The big boats beached by the bridge, I think, was the title of the story. Talk about that, and I thought the sort of the negative side of it was the business with the railroads, but...
Yeah, I love alliteration, actually. I had an editor once that went back to writing. He said, the only creative thing I get to do is to write headlines. So, anyway, this was really a cool story. And when Joanne first told me about it, I thought it would be good for a page. But she was River Lorien on this boat, and it was one of the large American cruise line boats, the Serenade, and they were coming upstream by Sebula, Iowa, which is across from Savannah, Illinois, and the railroad bridge there, which is an old swing bridge. Those are the ones where the bridge kind of pivots open and then pivots closed again. A part was broken or something on that, so it was really hard to open. They had to do it manually. And so the boats were stuck, a couple of the big cruise boats were stuck there. And the one boat, Serenade, pulled up by a campground. And there were a bunch of people there camping in their trailers with their boats, a bunch of river rats. And they got permission from the folks to let the passengers come out and mingle and hang out and buy T-shirts at the local marina, and it's a lovely article. I think she did a good job with it, but it was an extra benefit rather than it being a big problem of being stuck there and having to sit in the boat. It was actually something that people really enjoyed, and the weather was nice, and they learned about river life. A lot of the people on those boats are from other parts of the country, and
the world.
Or the world. And they would never get a chance to do that normally. So yeah, it was a pretty cool story. I liked it.
I liked it a lot. And on the sort of on the negative side, I mean, there were some issues that the railroad was supposed to be doing but hasn't always been good about it.
Well, there's always been a struggle between the railroads and the boats, because when the first railroad bridge went across the Mississippi down in the Quad Cities, the boat pilots were worried that they'd crash the boats into the piers. And the first one that was built actually was burned down, and there was a big legal suit about the boats demanding not to be impeded on the river. But, of course, the railroads wanted to get out west, where there was a lot of lumber and a lot of settlers moving at that time. And there was a young attorney that represented the railroads, and I think his name was Abraham Lincoln. And they ended up getting the right to build the bridges, but they have to keep the river open for the boats too. And it gets kind of contentious at times. And the the railroads have a reputation of being kind of complicated to deal with.
Well. That's for sure. You mentioned Savannah, Illinois, there just a minute ago, and there's a nice, really interesting feature article in the new issue that looks at three struggling small Mississippi River towns. One of them is Savannah, Illinois. Another, Cassville, Wisconsin, and the third was Lansing, Iowa, if I'm not mistaken. What do these communities have in common?
Well, I lived in Detroit and Milwaukee and that before I moved out into rural southeastern Minnesota, and I really get claustrophobic in the cities, and I often wonder why these small towns don't have more people kind of fleeing the city and moving to these small towns, especially since, in theory, people can work on from home, you know, over the internet and so on. So we looked at these three towns a few years ago in 2020, because this was during the beginning of the pandemic, and people were speculating that because there were so many people working from their homes, that there would be a big migration to these small towns. And we picked these three because houses are really inexpensive all three of them, but especially Savannah and Cassville, because Cassville, the main employer, was a huge Army depot just outside of town there that employed thousands of people, and they closed that in 2000. And so there are still a lot of empty houses in Savannah, and it's a beautiful river town. And then Lansing doesn't have a bridge, and that's kind of pretty far from, well, no, Lansing does have a bridge. I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Cassville. Cassville doesn't have a bridge, and it's a little out of the way, but they used to have two big power plants, one just right in the middle of town, and the other one upstream a little bit, and both of those power plants were closed just a couple years apart, and though they were the main employers in Cassville, and Cassville is kind of off the beaten track. It doesn't have a big highway going through it. And then Lansing, too, had the main employer closed. It used to be a place that made buttons from freshwater mussels, and they turned into a button factory and that, and they left. And so we looked at these three towns in 2020, and then we went back and looked at them this year and saw what progress they were or weren't making, and to see if there is really a renaissance occurring in these small towns. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem that there is. They're adapting in different ways and trying to be creative about it, but it's still kind of tough. And it's not just river towns, but we're a river magazine, so we focused on them. But, you know, the agricultural sector in the Driftless area, a lot of these small towns, things have become automated so much, and agriculture has changed so much that schools are closing, and, you know, it's a problem in rural America, and we'll come back to these towns in a few years and do it again and see how they're doing.
Yeah, I think one of the sort of positives, at least for one of the towns, if I'm remembering, was they were kind of getting some retirees who were choosing that place to retire. So if it was any, they were kind of looking at retirees as a source.
Yeah, all three of them are to a degree, and people do that, but then the constraint there is medical care, because I think Lansing has probably done the best with that, and it's a beautiful town, and almost everyone in town is a river rat too, which is, makes it kind of interesting. But you know, they have to drive to La Crosse to, you know, Gunderson Clinic or Mayo for a lot of their medical care, which gets kind of difficult in the winter sometimes. And then they're building a new bridge, which has meant the old bridge has been closed intermittently this year too. So it's tough. And I think the retirees, the baby boomers, are all retiring, and that's going to give them the opportunity to move out. But a lot of small town hospitals have closed too. So
yeah, there's that healthcare is definitely a big thing. Well, 3 years from now, you and I can sit down and talk about what's happened in the last 3 years, I guess.
Yeah, well, we'll keep our fingers crossed. It'll get a little better. Yeah.
Well, there was a city well in Hastings, Minnesota, was found to be polluted with PFAS, or, you know, the forever chemicals, that were believed to originate at a 3M plant.
Yeah, 3M, this PFAS, or I don't know, is it PFAS or PFAS?
I'm not sure.
It's both of them. Both of them are a problem. 3M really had probably its biggest facilities in that stretch of the river just upstream of Hastings. And they kind of thought, well, they didn't really think it was harmless. They knew there were problems, but they kind of kept it to themselves for a while. And a lot of it ended up in landfills and so on, or just was actually just dumped into the river in wastewater. And so that whole part of the country is having problems with it. And Hastings is the most recent one. They found really high levels in some of their municipal wells, and they're trying to get help with that to get the water treated, which is very expensive to get PFAS out because it's dangerous at parts per billion. You know, I mean, it doesn't take much of it. So
yeah, it's definitely something to be concerned about. Well, you know, Lee Hendricks, I interviewed Lee for his book that he wrote, and he has a piece in your magazine. I mean, he writes often for it, but it was Steamboat Wrecker about the chain of rocks upstream of St. Louis. I found really interesting. Talk about why that was a dangerous section of the river for so many steamboats back in the early 1900s.
Yeah, there are a few parts of the river where it's rocky, where there are rapids. And the other one in our area is in the Quad Cities, and they managed to build a dam big enough to float the boats over the rapids. And in St. Louis, they were so big, or just upstream of St. Louis, that they actually built a canal to bypass those rapids. But during a lot of the year, the rocks are sticking right out of the water. You can see in some of the photos with this story. And we have people sometimes get a virus or something, and they feel like they have to paddle the entire length of the Mississippi River. And they often stop by the office, you know, or get in contact with us. And I'm surprised how many people do that without having maps or being aware of things. And I've told a couple of them, now, before you get to St. Louis, stay to the left side of the river and go around. There's a big chain of rocks there. And they didn't even, you know, the river's pretty deep down that way, and you don't expect things like that. But it's geology, you know, and that's what they had to do to fix it.
Jeff and Barry Mills, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, well, good morning, gentlemen. Or good afternoon, I guess. Now, I just wanted to follow up with Reggie. I think it was over a year ago, maybe we talked about this Wendy's Queen riverboat that was docked across from Blackhawk Park. It was a floating restaurant. I was wondering if you ever got a chance to follow up on that.
You know, I have been trying to get some information about that ever since you talked to me about it, and I can't find any information. I should maybe just go down to Stoddard or Genoa and just walk the streets and talk to people about it, because I've been trying to find out about it. When was it open? Do you remember the years? It was the early 70s, right, or late 60s?
I had moved to Stoddard in about 76, so it had to be somewhere right around 1980, somewhere.
Really?
Between 76 and 80, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll keep at it, and if you find out anything, send it to me at Big River Post Office Box 204, Winona, Minnesota 55987. And it sounds like an interesting story, because I think you said it was only accessible by boat, correct?
Yep, they did it just like they do at the fishing barges. You pulled up a flag at Blackhawk Park, and they would come over and get you.
Yeah, no, that sounds cool. And there's not much on the other side except, you know, cropland and swamps and stuff. So So, yeah, no, I'd like to find out more about it, and we'll do a story if I can find out some more. And maybe someone who's listening will get in touch with us about that.
Yeah, for sure. Jeff, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Reggie McLeod, our guest today, as we talk with him about Big River Magazine and life along the Mississippi. Questions, comments, or maybe an experience to share, give a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Just to make a mention, tomorrow on the show we talk with Craig Handel about helping groundskeeper George Toma write his biography. That it's titled The Sod Father, An Extraordinary Journey in the Shadows of Sport's Greatest Fields, like the Super Bowl fields. Then we talk to John Greenberg, president of the Milwaukee Admirals hockey team. So we'll talk a little sports tomorrow on the show. Right now, life along the Mississippi, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Randy in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Randy.
Well, hi. Yeah, thanks. I read a book by John McPhee, and for the life of me, I can't remember the name of it because I'm old and I can't remember half the stuff I have done. This book, he talks about the river from the headwaters all the way down to Louisiana, and towards the end of the river, the story that he tells is there's a whole lot of problems in the Department of Engineers that would deal with that are not dealing with it because it's going to be really expensive.
Well, I think you're talking about The Control of Nature by John McPhee.
Yeah.
And he talked about the Mississippi River is accustomed to changing its course right at the end. And every 2,000 years about, it would carve a whole new path, a shorter path to the Gulf of Mexico, because as it flows out into the Gulf of Mexico, it carries a lot of sediment, and that builds up, and it makes the river longer and longer and longer. And as it does that, it's going slower and slower, and eventually it finds a shortcut that it wants to take. And it's been trying to take a shortcut to the Atchafalaya River, which branches out to the west of the Mississippi by Baton Rouge. And the Army Corps of Engineers built, I think it's called the River Control Structure. They built basically a dam on the confluence between the Atchafalaya and the Mississippi River to keep the Mississippi River from taking the shortcut, which is what it wants to do. But it would be enormously expensive because of all of the port facilities and so on that they have in New Orleans and even Baton Rouge and that stretch in between the two. So if it took that shortcut, all of that infrastructure would be pretty much useless. And they'd have to make a lot of changes on that new course along the Atchafalaya. They'd have to, you know, worry about the floods and buildings that would be underwater and so on and so forth. So they built that structure, and as time goes on, there's more and more pressure for it to go that way, and it's kind of harder and harder to contain. And when the water gets really high some years, they actually route it to the east through Lake Pontchartrain to take some of the pressure off. And yeah, everyone's worried about it. You know, it's one of those, they call it kicking the can down the road.
Yeah.
that's basically what it is. And they're still building facilities for shipping and barges and all of that in New Orleans. And that stretch, they're assuming it's going to go on forever, at least for the next 10 or 20 years. But eventually it's going to have its way, and it's going to go take the shortcut.
Yeah. Randy, thanks a lot for calling. That was an interesting little sidelight to this.
Yeah.
Philip in Trempolo. We'll go to you now. Hi, Philip.
Hello. So talking about the rocks along the Mississippi River, I haven't thought about this in years, but when I worked on the towboats in the 70s and 80s, we used to be awakened by the captain as we went through those rock cuts because it was so risky to get through there safely, even with the modern towboats. But I just remembered all of those nights that I might be asleep and the watch would wake you up and you'd have to stay up in the wheelhouse and kind of look for the captain as you were going through.
No.
Really? Wow, was it at the chain of rocks then? Or?
Yep, it was a chain of rocks.
Oh, okay. Yeah, when the floodwaters are high, and of course the water on the Mississippi normally, you know, can fluctuate by 10 or 20 feet. So if you have rocks sticking out of the water and then it's, you know, 15 feet higher, a towboat can go over that safely. But it's still tricky, as I understand it. And Lee, who wrote the story, he's an accomplished pilot, and he said he wouldn't want to try it. So yeah. Did you guys have your life jackets on when you were up there in the pilot house? Or?
Oh yeah. It was everyone had to get their life jackets, and you had to actually stand on the side of the wheelhouse and talk to the pilot as he was going and saying, yeah, one guy was responsible for calling out how close the stern was to the rocks.
Oh boy. Yeah.
Oh.
But fun.
Yeah. And Philip, just in passing, you might be interested if you haven't read Lee Hendrick's book, and I'm forgetting the title of it now.
Oh, Peep Light, is that it? Gosh.
Well, look up Lee Hendricks, Philip, and he wrote a book about his life on a towboat. It's sort of a history of his time on towboats, and I think you'd find it interesting. Peep Light, yeah.
Peep Light, yeah, yeah.
The title of the book is Peep Light.
Yeah, he's a good writer, good storyteller, and he's piloted those big passenger boats as well as towboats. And he was a pilot on the biggest towboat on the river, which is an Army Corps towboat called the MV Mississippi, which is so big they have a banquet room in it. It's like, it's wild. And,
it's an interesting book for sure. We talked about it. Actually, you could go back to one of our old shows, if you write his name in, it'll probably pop up in the search engine, and you could listen to the interview I had with him a year or two back now about the book. Anyway, yeah. Philip, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. I want to get to, I think your longest story is the one you wrote in your book, in your magazine, about coyotes in the Driftless area. I found it very interesting.
Yeah, I did too. I had lived with them and heard them a lot of times out in the country. And when I started digging around, the thing that most surprised me is they're not native to this area. They have just come up here recently. And in like the 1960s and 1970s, they were migrating in here. So they're kind of an alien species, but they've become a native species. I mean, they fit right in, but they weren't here because the wolves and I don't know how many mountain lions there were around here, but there were definitely a lot of wolves. They kept them out. You know, they're mortal enemies. But once the wolves were pretty much wiped out, the coyotes moved all across the country. They're out on the East Coast, and that was interesting. And the other thing is how they breed with wolves and dogs. And when you get out east, a lot of them are different colors and different sizes. And now that they can look at DNA, and I didn't do a lot about this, but I read some papers about it, they find that they got their red hair from dogs and they got these different characteristics from, they're basically almost the same species. You know, they're actually three different species, but they kind of overlap a bit genetically. And I found that interesting, too. But they're very smart, very, very adaptable. I mean, there's a big difference between living in the desert and living in Ontario, you know, and but they do it. They're quite successful at it.
And there have been a few incidences of coyotes biting people, but not a ton, I don't think.
No, not around here especially. And there's a lot of them in Madison, Larry, so be yes. careful when you're out riding your bike. But no, they really, there are almost no reports of attacks on humans in the Midwest. There was a young woman who was killed by a couple of coyotes out on the East Coast a few years ago, a musician. And that's kind of a mystery as to why that happened, because it's really an unusual occurrence.
I wanted to talk about, in the last couple of minutes, about the future of the magazine. You're raising some money to move Big River magazines to a nonprofit ownership model. How's your, and you have a $150,000 goal. How's that all going?
Slow. It's so complicated. We finally got the last papers filed where we can directly raise money. We've been doing it through a fiscal agent. We just got the final determination on that like about a week ago. And so now we can really ramp it up a lot more. We've been kind of holding back until we had all that in order. But we're going to the nonprofit exists, and it has raised some money, and we've gotten good support. But when they reach a certain threshold, it'll actually be $75,000 when it'll buy all the assets of the magazine, and they'll be transferred to the nonprofit, and all the employees will be hired by the nonprofit. We're going to be in the same offices and the same accounts and everything. It's just going to become a nonprofit. And we have a really good board of directors with a lot of experience on river issues and grant writing. And we have one of the guys was in charge of water quality in the Mississippi River for the Wisconsin DNR. And it's exciting, and I think it's going to allow us to do some things that we couldn't do before, do more in-depth reporting, and maybe do some more things that will reach kids. And like your archives, we want to create an archive of all our back issues on the web that'll be searchable, so people can go back 32 years. This current issue completed 32 years of publishing, so it's a lot of content.
That's an amazing, amazing what should I say? It's an achievement. For you, Reggie.
Yeah, thank you. It's been quite a trip, but yeah.
I was trying to find somebody had. I think there's like about 6,000 segments in my time here that we have back issues that are podcasts. So.
Yeah, well, you're doing two a day, cranking them on. You do a great job, too. I mean, the span of the things that you cover on there is amazing, yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure, as always, Reggie. I really enjoy, and we did not cover everything in the magazine, for sure. There's a lot more in it, and I always appreciate your visits, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much.
Me too. Well, thank you, Larry.
Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. It's always great to have him with us. And thank you for listening. Listen, and all our shows are really a team effort. We had our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. And I'm the guy that's usually on the air, most of the time anyway, Larry Mueller. I thank you all for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.